I don't believe in ghosts. Never have. But I've had the unfortunate experience of meeting not one, but three. In Canada, of all places. In the southeast of Ontario, not so far from Lakes Ontario and Erie, lies the university town of Guelph. The suburbs nestle close to the town centre, for the town is old. Place names in Guelph resonate with their Scottish ancestry and with the battles of the Napoleonic Wars. In the northwest suburbs, there is a street of fine early Victorian houses. These are large, generously proportioned. Many were refurbished and improved in the mid-late 1800s, so they must have been established a while before then. These were the original townhouses of the rich burghers of Guelph. One of them is haunted by ghosts. The house stands three stories high. To the front is a ground floor veranda with balustrades and steps leading up to it. The whole frontage is adorned with heavy painted fretted woodwork. The roofs are steep, dark, Gothic and complex. Where it has been possible to embellish, to carve, to ornament, to detail, to add grandeur, then this has been done. The house looked as if it had benefited from a further refurbishment and makeover, perhaps in the late 1930s. Before that, however, it seemed to have fallen on hard times. The ghosts of this house do not wish the human race well. The top floor of the house is constructed in the apices of what must be three roofs running at right angles. A steep and cornered stair leads up from a back entrance, passing to the rear of the rooms of the main house, to finish up in a small central living area. Off this is a kitchen space with room for a table to both prepare food and eat from. There are three bedrooms, each quite small but big enough for a double bed. These attic rooms must have been, as originally constructed, the servants' quarters and would happily have accommodated the cook and a couple of chambermaids. I was in one of the maid's rooms. The maid, if maid was all that she was, which I doubt, did not like my taste in religious music. At the time of my lodging there, it must have been the 1980s, I was the proud possessor of a state-of-the-art laptop, which could play compact discs. So with me were a dozen or so CDs, mostly of various requiems, masses and the like. Mozart, Verdi, Bach, Fauré. They were piled neatly on the bedside table. The computer would play me to sleep last thing at night. When the discs crashed to the floor, waking me with a start, I presumed that they had been stacked carelessly before I had retired to bed. By being sleepy, maybe lazy, they were left where they had fallen until morning. This would all have been unremarkable were it not for the fact that the same occurred the following night. Only on that second occasion I felt ill at ease. The room was not cold, but there was a sense of chill. The upstairs of the house was just fine for me. The room opposite was occupied by an ice hockey playing student who appeared to have both beds and bedtime companions elsewhere in the town readily at his disposal, and he used them to the full. The room next door had a prospective emigre from Lancashire, a plumber, who was looking for employers. He was using the house as a base, travelling a fair bit. This meant that I could cook, study, work, and have my being in relative solitude. The ghosts of the house, however, were not minded to let that happy state continue. The owner was, like so many of those who run lodgings for a business, a practical man with a talent for builder work. My entry through the back door of the house and the stair up was littered with broken plaster, wood lath and timbers. It had all come out of one of the bedroom ceilings of the floor below me. With the neat stack of new planks waiting in the back garden, it looked as if the floor was to be taken up too. He was obviously handy with a hammer, for the banging of wood and the ripping of masonry could go on until 9 or 10 at night. Not that it bothered me, but it may have bothered her ladyship. I saw her first, coming down the lower stair one evening as I was going up. She was upright, elegant, hair coiffured. I waited on the half landing to let her pass. Upon reflection, her style of dress was quaint, but at the moment of our meeting, one was more concerned with the necessary politenesses. After all, it was her house, and I was a guest. Who knows what evening wear might be thought proper for a grandmother in provincial Canada. She wished me a good evening, welcomed me to her house, and looked keenly at me, exclaiming, "I am so sorry that you have not been properly introduced to me." I mumbled my name and that my business was at the university. She replied with the utmost of courtesy, but not without a hint of severity, a hint that I was clearly meant to register. I felt suitably admonished. "It really is so bad of John to invite noteworthy guests and then not to let me know." I got the feeling, though, that the failings were on my part, not hers. Such is often the way with ladies of position. She passed on down. I reflected that her demeanour was clearly that of the mistress of the house. The pleasant woman of 40 or so, who had met me when I first arrived, must therefore be her daughter, or daughter-in-law. When I next met said daughter, I mentioned my encounter with her mother. The response was a sharp glance and a comment added to the effect that her mother lived in Toronto. It was left to pass. I did not meet the old lady again, but the plumber did. Apparently an identical exchange had taken place. The plumber, more perceptive than myself, commented that a fancy dress party seemed to be in the offing. My next awakening was an altogether different affair. It was the cold that aroused me. I found myself sitting up in the bed. The chill seemed to have got into my spine. To my consternation, the hair was standing up on the back of my head and neck. I was shivering. I was not alone. And the person with me was deeply aggrieved. I felt surrounded by injustice and complaint. Seeing nothing in the dark, I fumbled for the bedside light. Upon turning on the light, to my horror, two things happened. First, there was nothing to be seen. Second, the presence became more powerful and her feelings more intense. That she was female, there was no doubt. Desperately, I fumbled at the computer and got it reset to play. The B minor mass came to my aid. She faded, or should I say the presence faded, for I had not seen her, as I had the older lady. it was more that I knew that she was there without needing to see her. I left the light on but did not sleep until it was time to get up. Meanwhile, I tried to rationalise. I could get no further than my being acutely aware, in the mind of another person, of a huge weight of unhappiness and depression. The builder work in the old house had come to a temporary stop. The stair was cleared of debris, and it was easier to work in the evening. The new planks lay still in the garden. The plumber was faring better in his searches and had taken on temporary work in the town. He was good company. The ice hockey player turned up every now and again, but if there were parties, he held them elsewhere. I was able, on the kitchen table at the top of the old house, to produce some new algorithms for the mathematical models we were working on at the university. A week or so later, upon returning to my digs, the stack of planks in the garden had had its tarpaulin cover thrown back, and some quarter of the floorboards had been removed. A few of these were yet on the stair. Going up to my garret on the third floor, I looked in to see that the second floor bedroom had indeed got new flooring laid across the joists. My do-it-yourself landlord was back on the job. Sometime about 3 in the morning, I woke to the left-hand side of my double bed being compressed. It was a feeling with which I was well familiar. It was the very same as when one's partner for the night puts her weight upon the bed edge in preparation for lifting the covers and getting in. There was someone sitting on the side of my bed. She sat there for a little while, still. Then the bed shifted, as did her weight, causing the mattress to compress. She was getting in with me. I had, after my previous experience, taken to sleeping with the light on. The fact that there was nothing to be seen made not one jot of difference to my having company in bed. She was neither happy nor unhappy. She was simply resigned. She seemed to be doing merely what she was in the habit of doing or needing to do. I felt a degree of ill will toward me. The aura of hopelessness about her was all-pervading. I was for some time, which could have been seconds or minutes, totally unable to move. When I did, her gaze was upon me. The bed moved, the weight lifted, the depression in the mattress reformed from where her body had been. She left me. The chill went with her. Although I did not see her, I can well describe her. She was 30 years or so. She was naked. She was not unattractive. Had it not been for her being so careworn and weighed down upon. Her hair was fair and washed, but her face was lined. She had hands with long fingers, though the skin was coarse. Her getting into my bed was, as it were, nothing more than a matter of what her life had placed upon her. She was coming into the bed in the full knowledge that it was occupied, but she was reluctant. If this was the chambermaid in whose room I now lived, did she usually sleep in a double bed? Or did she have other duties? On this occasion, I did return to sleep, but only with the help of Taverner's The Lamb. Following my first spell in the boarding house at Guelph, I absconded for a fortnight of recreation in the Rocky Mountains under the pretext of visiting the agriculture faculty at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. I had managed to engineer a stay in the CPR Banff Springs Hotel, when it was still the smartest hotel in all of Canada. There, not only to ski Norquay Mountain, but also to bathe in the warm waters outdoors at minus 20 degrees Celsius, whilst the hair on my head accumulated a layer of white ice. Having done Norquay, I ventured on to the snow bowl at Sunshine Village, up on the Rocky Mountains divide between East Banff National Park and West Assiniboine National Park. I was told Lake Louise was even better, so passed the second week up there in Chateau Lake Louise, the second of the great CPR hotels in the Rockies. Louise was a most wonderful place with the best dry powder snow I've ever had the fortune to meet. All good things must end, and I was due back for a further week of work at the University of Guelph, developing pig growth algorithms with colleagues vastly superior to me in mathematics, but needing inputs by way of realistic biological possibilities. The university department was one thing. The boarding house was another. I convinced myself that there would be no more ghosts, which in any event were more likely to be living in my head than in the top floor of a perfectly acceptable boarding house. I was wrong. The next happening will be difficult for me to recount, but not as difficult as things were at the time. Worse, I fear that the cynical listener will by now be looking to analyse my own position in all of this, not least that I was visiting another country alone, working a sabbatical at the university there. I was away from my home and the comforts of my own dear wife. The sceptic I may be able to persuade, but the cynic is never open to persuasion. Trips away from home have been common through my life, but never before and never since have such things occurred as occurred at that house in Guelph. I happened upon the back stair to meet my DIY landlord and asked, as good manners would dictate, how his renovations were progressing. He was being helped enthusiastically by his young teenage daughter. They were going well, apparently. He was not the sort that would have found house renovation in any way a daunting prospect. He told me that ripping up the old house and putting it back together again was a fascinating and rewarding task. He felt that he had a duty to the heritage that was, for the time being, in his care. The house, he told me, had suffered a decline in fortune between the times of the two main renovations, the first toward the end of the 1800s and the second around the 1930s. The neglect was obvious to him when he had stripped back the layers of wallpaper and delved behind the wall panelling. The gas fittings were of poor quality and the plumbing scant for such a grand house. The interior seemed to have been divided into sections, each with a big fire and cooking facilities. Then each section had been subdivided into smaller rooms. The walls to these rooms were thin and mean, of cheap soft wood and plasterboard daubed with brown varnish paint, quite in contrast to the solid, well-kept walls of the original rooms. Thanks to my host's love of his work and his house, the principal rooms were now in the final stages of their restoration to their former generous proportions. For him, a part of the attractive personality of the house lay in its having, in a previous age, fallen on hard times. In this respect, other mansions in the same street had, it seemed, suffered similar fates. I was on this occasion awake, having not long put down my book. I was dozing when the temperature noticeably chilled. Upon opening my eyes, there was nothing to be seen. The presence in the room strengthened. A sense of dread was overwhelming. I was surrounded by power. There could have been a score of condemned souls in the room. The feeling of anguish was so crushing, though I knew there to be only one. The forces came together and coalesced at the foot of my bed. I quite expected there to be a materialization of some sort and was terrified of the prospect of what might then happen. There was to be no materialization, just the presence. She did not need to have any material being. I knew with a horrifying certainty exactly who and what she was. What I knew in that instant, it was not acceptable to know. The child was aged about 13 or 14. She was slight, but not ill-formed. She was soundlessly crying. She was looking at me in the way that asks for that which it is known will not be granted. She was in abject misery. This was not the sorrow of the moment, where all things were well before and all things will be well again. This was the misery that comes from things never having been well, and the certainty that there will be no relief from pain, only the endurance of it. Even though her head was down, her eyes were upon me, or upon whoever occupied the space where I was. The weight of unhappiness bearing down upon me became more than I could tolerate. I felt the force of her existence further strengthen. There, at the end of the bed, she was an arm's length from me. She would be bound to materialize. I could not contemplate the possibility that the immensity of my present emotion might become a physical reality. I feared for my life. Not that the child was to be feared. It was that I might not be capable of dealing with the searing depth of the child's pain. I spoke. I have no idea what I said. My panic subsided somewhat as the child at the foot of the bed seemed to gather herself. The abuse for which she had been bidden to come here was, for her, an inevitability. Nevertheless, she sought release from it. I was both the source of her impending abuse and the means of her release. My own agony was unacceptable. I was deeply insulted that I should be presumed to be the cause of her misery. But I was also chosen as the means of her salvation. These things needed to be separated. Her place and time and my place and time. Somehow they'd come together. There was an imperative upon me to resolve this most disturbing of fusions, and urgently. Along with my grief for the child, my own anger was building. Anger and resentment that it was I who was being accused. Accused of things that I did not do, could not do, and have no knowledge of their doing. For the girl, time had no meaning. What is now and what was a lifetime ago were all but the same to her. With the accusations, there came from her also a plea for help. Help that it was not in my competence to give. I stretched out for the CD player on the computer, the Requiem in D. The tension in the room eased. The girl at the end of the bed quietened. She did not go. I trembled at the possibilities of her reaction to the deer's earache, but knew we must, each in our separate worlds, get through it. After that, I left it to Mozart. At last, ever so slowly, the weight of the presence faded. My feelings of being outrageously unjustly accused waned. The sorrow and the anger did not. She left me. The room warmed up. Maybe I did help. Maybe not. Maybe just drawing to myself some of her grief had attenuated the depths of her misery. We were visiting the Niagara Falls. My host at the university department had decided that it would make a good family outing to commemorate the end of my stay. One advantage of a visit to Niagara is that the country route goes through vineyards. These may be visited and the vintages tasted. In a quiet moment, I asked obliquely about the history of the road that I had been lodging in and the fine old Victorian mansions along that part of the street nearest to downtown Guelph. He grinned, saying that there were stories that in the Depression, in the late 1920s to early 30s, the street had fallen on hard times. Rumour had it that at least one of these grand houses had operated as a slave brothel. The idea seemed to amuse him. It did not amuse me.